You don't mind if I'm flossing while we do this because I'm going to the dentist immediately afterwards?
If you floss the day before, they know that you flossed just now.
Yeah, because your gums are raw.
Yeah.
Not used to it.
Yeah, usually you have a lot of bacon packed in there, Mark. What happened?
Oh.
In tech we trust. We're not sure about.
Turn up your volume, everyone. I get the feeling the recording today is going to come out a lot quieter now that we are without the booming tones of Hans. So,
oh, tears, pain.
Oh.
It is true, though. He's left the building. Sad, but you know what? That's life, right? The infrastructure tech world pauses for no one, so the show goes on. Let's see who we've got this week. Well, I think we heard in the background we've got Mark, at least.
Now!
Hey! Mark, you might not be on at the end of the show. Tell us why.
Well, I'm going to the dentist.
Is this like for something bad or is it just a regular checkup?
Every time I go, it's for something bad. You know, 6 months, 6 months ago, it was like, we're going to replace this crown. And I thought, nah. And I've made it 6 months without that much pain. So they're going to tell me again, you're going to need to replace the crown. I'm just going to say, I'm going to hold firm. Just put the glue in there.
Oh, okay.
Hey, that's Mark, only take care of the teeth you want to keep, okay? That's my dad's rule.
Is that just the front ones, yeah?
Dude, yeah, my chipmunk chompers.
Hey, like, I know you American guys quite often make fun of British people for not having great dental hygiene in comparison to you guys. This is a true story, right? I got a friend. I mean, he's a bit older. I say he's a bit older. He's in his 60s. But his dad had toothache once when he was a kid. When my friend was a kid, so his dad was like, I don't know what he was, 30 or something. He went to the dentist and the dentist took his tooth out. And he said to the dentist, you know what? I'm not game for that kind of pain again. Just take them all out. And he did. And you know what? That apparently, that kind of thing was fairly common back in the day in England. And I say back in the day, I don't know, 50 years ago, something like that. But can you imagine doing that? Going to the dentist and saying, you know what? That pain was pretty bad. Yank them all out, will you? That's like insane. Yeah, you know, things have moved on, I'm glad to say.
Yeah, I've had to have a couple root canals, and there were times when I would have said the same thing.
Yeah, actually, my wife had root canal, and she was up all night once. It was horrific for me, so I don't know how bad it was for her. And I was just, like, nursing her. Anyway, Rick, you're around, yeah?
Yeah, hey, guys. I'm out here in San Diego. Oddly, it is 22 degrees cooler here in San Diego than it is in Columbus, Ohio, which is home. I went over and did a little bit of fist bump, hug, and run with Gabriel, but he actually had the real work thing going on, so he wasn't able to join us.
So you guys are at Cisco Live, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. You know what? So there's no Gabriel this week. Obviously, there's no more Hans, but we do have a guest with us. So Josh DeYoung. Josh, I really hope I did pronounce that right. Why don't you give all the listeners just a quick intro into who you are and what you do?
I'm a, I guess, systems architect. I've been working with VMware and storage and pretty much everything in infrastructure for going on, I think, 11 years now or something. And I'm actually down here at in San Diego at Cisco Live with Rick.
So what happened? Rick kidnapped you from the floor. Yeah. Thank you. Round of applause.
Yeah, voluntold him for the podcast, man.
Yeah, I like that. I've not heard that before. Voluntold him.
But cool. Your Twitter handle belies a different strategy.
What is your Twitter handle, actually, Josh?
Eurobrew.
So where does that come from?
I probably had that for maybe 16 years, I think. It was just something that I came up, or that was actually given to me by a friend of mine, and just, you know, always been a big coffee fan, and so just kind of stuck.
Oh, it's to do with coffee.
It's coffee, not beer. Oh, I'm crying in my coffee.
Mark's like a legend in the brewing communities of California these days.
For screwing up.
Yeah, I'm waiting for you to change your Twitter handle, Mark, to like Farley the Brewer or something like that.
Yeah, maybe Brew Farley. Brew Farley.
What the Brew Farley?
Yeah, that'd be good, actually. Anyway, so might be a bit of a shorter show, I don't know, with you nicking off a little bit later, Mark. So just a quick follow-on from last week's show. We did talk a little bit briefly in the show last week about Cisco reshuffling the deck with their senior execs. Well, this week, new CEO in waiting, Chuck Robbins, named his 10-man exec team. Well, not all men, actually. But what I thought was interesting, and I think we did touch on this, maybe not last week, maybe it was the week before, nine of his new 10 people are internal folks, with only just one person coming in from externally. So that was Ruba Borno. She's coming in from the Boston Consulting Group, and I think she looks pretty interesting personally. She's got a degree in electrical engineering, and check this out, right? She's been an Intel Fellow at the National Space Foundation Engineering Research Center. So she knows her tech, right? That's pretty cool, I think. You know what, though? I don't really have anything to say on the team that they're putting together at Cisco, but I did have just a quick question around, you know what? I don't know how many of the execs are changing, but in all the articles that I read, this is like not a wholesale change, but they are ringing the changes there. Is that generally a good thing to make like loads of changes at the top like that?
I think so, and Josh might confirm, but I've heard the phrase the new Cisco this week, and it's not by any like broad official statement, but I've heard that used today, this week, and I think that the fact that, you know, and I have this nice infographic that I shared in our notes. Hopefully, maybe it'll make it on the podcast page.
Yeah.
But it's like they have really tried to communicate this change, and you know, it's a big change. They're communicating it well. I think the fact that they have most of these changes from within, I think that's very positive myself, because honestly, Cisco's making money, not that much needs to change, right? So I think when you look at it that way.
But how can it be the new Cisco if nine people are coming from internal, right? I mean, there can't be that much change going to happen.
Just saying, it's what I heard.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the new Cisco, I mean, that's just marketing hype. It's just spin. You know, it's just they're trying to come up with something. Who cares, right? What are they going to do, call it the same old Cisco? I mean, they're going to call it something.
Are we going to call the show the We Hate Cisco Show? Because I just got slammed on Twitter earlier, somebody from NetApp saying, oh, those guys should call it the We Hate NetApp Show because we're always slamming on NetApp, apparently.
I love NetApp. Come on.
I know. I don't know where it was coming from. Never mind. Hey, do you think, though, there's any chance that they could repair the relationship with EMC over the whole VCE, I don't even know what to call it these days, but the whole split up and fallout there? Or is that something that's in the past, you know what, they're both moving on from that?
I don't think it's fixable.
You don't think it's fixable?
No. Why fix it? I think the new Cisco comes out guns a-blazing and isn't so, you know, like, quiet about it and say everything's good. I think the new Cisco says, you hurt me, I'm punching you.
Yeah, that'd be good, wouldn't it? Just mix it up a bit there.
We can only hope. Yeah.
The new exec team doesn't take over till the 26th of July, so there won't be any bust-ups until at least then. So fingers crossed that there will be, though.
I think it's really quite possible for newcomers and new team from internally to really make significant change. And probably not too large a change, right? What you want to do is try to make incremental steps. And you look at what Microsoft did with Satya Nadella, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so they brought in Satya. And Satya's done a lot of good things at Microsoft. I think most people would agree with that. And some people might say he hasn't gone far enough yet, right? And the difference there is, you know, if you really wanted to bust up a company, you'd bring in a lot of outsiders. But if you want to keep things running where you go, you know, we've got a lot of talent. We've got a lot of good stuff going. We're going to change reporting structures. You know, we're going to change, you know, who the people are making those decisions. They can do that. You know, it puts everybody on notice, you know, when there's that wholesale change at the top, but it's not like there's a jackhammer coming, run for the doors, find your next job. Because it's too easy to get one these days.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when they're that big, that's important. You know,
huge.
Those big of a company, Microsoft, Cisco, they cannot, flip it out overnight. Like Grid Store could or something.
No, absolutely not. The ship would capsize, wouldn't it? That thing turns like, well, it's got a turning circle of I don't know what.
It's a turning line.
Yeah, a straight one. All right then. So actually on the topic of Cisco.
I just got that.
Sharpest tool in the toolbox, yeah.
There I am, yeah.
So, Rick, you're at Cisco Live, and actually, Josh, you are too. So I know, Rick, you'd plan to give us some thoughts on the show, what you've taken from it. Why don't you lead us out on that?
Well, I'm still taking it in, so I guess I'll do our normal major industry event thing 1 week later. I'm actually personally more curious to Josh's take, right? He's like the end user. Josh always has an opinion on things, and but you know what he's seen from partners and to an extent from Cisco. I'm just curious his opinion more because I'm still digesting the notes myself.
Go on, let's have it then, Josh.
You know, I think at this point there's not a lot of appeal that has come out of this for someone like me. And I think when you know, like looking at my background and looking at what I've kind of primarily focused on and, you know, virtualization and storage and really kind of avoiding, networking in my past. For me, this has just been, I've been pretty bored here to be perfectly honest.
Hey, you know, I'm just,
we're hating.
It is the I Hate Cisco show. So what were we expecting really then, Josh, and what's missing from your perspective?
You know, and I think it's just content that doesn't necessarily appeal to me and to what I do. And, you know, usually, you know, having been at VMworlds in the past and getting a chance to, you know, to listen in on the keynotes and talk about direction, the company at a high level and having, you know, partners coming in and talking about what they're providing and how their businesses are aligning with that of VMware. And that's always been something that I thought, you know, VMworld really did a good job of. And really at Cisco Live, and again, I could just be me. It could just be my point of view on things, but, I just feel uninterested most of the time.
Hey, here's a question then to everybody. Do you reckon they're at a bit of an awkward period at Cisco at the moment? You know, Chambers is about to go. The new exec team's been announced. Everybody knows what their new jobs are going to be. But nobody really kicks into that new job. You know, they don't sit down in their new chairs until like the back end of next month. Are they in like this weird phase where it's like, oh, well, what do we do for like a month and a half?
Yeah, we all made our numbers. Heck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They might be doing that, but I think that's might be part of the reason why this, in my quote, new Cisco isn't really that new, so that it is business as normal. If it was a flipped up ship, you know, total 180, the money would stop. The little bit of wait and see enterprise spend has to stop and think about those types of things. So I think that's part of it. So I think it is business as usual for the long term as we make this slight variance here.
I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, the quick answer, right, is what's missing. And Josh basically said relevance to him. And that's an interesting thing. I mean, that's a pretty big miss.
Well, to be fair, I mean, the network story, but honestly, I haven't digested all the news, but you know, that's, granted, they want to do more in UCS, and they have a lot of big numbers. But what is the, you know, the big drive from the network? And that'll be my goal next week to report.
Looking forward to it. Josh, I have a question for you then. Do you wish you were at Nutanix? Is it, I don't even know how to pronounce this, to be honest. Is it .next or is it just Nutanix Next? Anyway, whatever it is, right? Do you wish you were there instead?
No, if I had to pick a place that I would rather be uninterested, I'd rather be uninterested here than there.
Oh, my goodness.
Good choice. Yes.
So is that to do with the location? Do you not like Miami or do you not like Nutanix?
It would be that I don't like Nutanix.
Oh, well, that's going to be interesting.
Man, I'm so glad you're not dissing on Miami. Go to Key West.
Like that. So big news out of that one, Nigel. I know where you're going with it.
Yeah, well, go on then. So you know what? The tech news for this week is pretty heavy on Nutanix. Just for the listeners, I've got two things for Nutanix. So I think the big announcement was around XCP, their extreme computing platform. And you know what? There's probably a bunch in there that we can talk about if we want. But they're starting to talk up scale out file services platform being somewhere on the horizon, expected to compete with NetApp. That's what I'm hearing. So I think the message at least has been, and you know what? Look, Nutanix, love them or hate them, they don't pull punches. They love to have a dig at VMware and what have you, and they've been having a bit of a dig at NetApp from what I've heard. We're coming for you, NetApp, is the message that I've been hearing. So those two things from NetApp, Next or .next, you know what, let's clear that up. Does anybody know how to pronounce it?
.next.
.next, all right. So Nutanix.next. Josh, Rick, I know both of you are not like massive fans, so whichever of you, I don't care who goes first, let's have your thoughts on it.
Well, I would say the fact that I'm looking at it from a business standpoint. This hypervisor, and I believe it's Acropolis, it's not really in the right realm of the ecosystem. I'm not a fan.
Okay, so I'm struggling to digest that. What do you mean it's not in the right realm of the ecosystem?
Well, I'm looking at it in a business standpoint. There's an ecosystem from vSphere and Hyper-V, and I believe they currently support both.
That's right, yeah.
And now there's this one of their own. And I understand, you know, they're trying to make, trying to make money. But this Acropolis hypervisor, you know, it still supports vSphere and Hyper-V, according to the news, the distributed storage fabric. But they have a native hypervisor based on Linux KVM.
Yeah.
So you're going another direction. And I personally am not a fan of that, but I can understand why they do it. Now, it's a weird opinion. I understand why they do it, but I don't like it.
So
I just don't like it. I don't like it. Blah.
Well, it's so interesting, right? From a technical perspective, okay. And they made some pops at VMware when they were talking about the hypervisor component of Acropolis, because I think Acropolis is a little bit more than that. It's like compute and storage and, you know, stuff like that. But
right.
The KVM, or the rip of KVM as a hypervisor, is in there. And their play was that it's a stripped down version of KVM. So it's like, and you know what? I don't even know how much mileage there really is in this, but they were bigging it up saying, you know, it's got a smaller footprint than Hyper-V and ESXi. And therefore, you'll be able to get better densities. I mean, by how much? I don't know. And they were making a play that it'll boot virtual machines faster and all of that. But the dig at VMware was, they have literally stripped down KVM here, taken all of the intelligence out of the hypervisor and put it somewhere else, which they were making as a dig against VMware. And I'm like, you know what? VMware don't necessarily have all the intelligence in the hypervisor. They've got so much intelligence in the wider ecosystem. So it's one, you know, personally, as a techie, I want to look at and I want to watch, but I'm not sure I particularly see any value. But Josh, I'm keen for your take on all of this.
You know, from my perspective, I feel like Nutanix has essentially solved a problem that I don't have. For who they've recruited and who they have out there evangelizing their product and the, I don't know how many VCDXs they've actually employed over the years. But what was, to me, I don't see the point of doing this. And really, you know, to Rick's perspective on this and his point of view is that, I mean, we have so many options when you go with Hyper-V or when you go with VMware and you look at the third-party components that are out there, these tools that we have at our disposal that we can throw and we can connect directly into VMware, into Hyper-V, and we can start working directly, backing up those virtual machines or accelerating them in some capacity or, you know, replication and whatever else is out there. And now you've created your own hypervisor to solve the problem of, that's where I'm lost, because I don't know what problem you've actually solved.
So as a Nutanix customer, well, I mean, I'm not one, I'm just saying, if you were a Nutanix customer, right, by going with their Acropolis stack, if I can call it that, so with their own hypervisor and what have you, is there the potential that you're going to cut out a bunch of cost for yourself as a customer so that you don't have to buy into licensing from third-party hypervisors and orchestration tools and things like that? Is that a potential?
Well, my, I guess, question about that is, I don't know if anyone had seen the blog post that Chuck Hollis from VMware had put out in terms of comparing the cost of Nutanix and a similarly configured or equally configured Supermicro array to run vSAN. But the cost, the MSRP of a Nutanix block or whatever they're called, comes to like $200,000. All right. Similarly configured Supermicro, running license for vSAN was, I think, $46,000 or $63,000, somewhere in there. So now you're paying a premium to Nutanix already of like $120,000 or more. You throw in licensing for VMware, for ESXi and vCenter on top of that. Maybe, I think retail, you're maybe looking at about 40 grand. So that's still $100,000 more roughly for Nutanix than it is for me to just build it in VMware and have the support of everybody else in, like third parties out there to be able to integrate any application or any software that's available to me without having to, deal with a one-off hypervisor.
Here's my problem. I was very emotional when I just said I don't like it, but let me qualify that. And I've collected my thoughts.
Did you shed a tear?
No. But if it's this modified KVM hypervisor, and when I say modified, meaning it's not something I can pick up and move to something else, does that mean lock in? Meaning I can only move to another Nutanix? That's a problem. I love abstraction. People change their mind on storage, compute, all those other things. Now, granted, some people do change their mind on hypervisors. So the theory is if you've committed to vSphere or Hyper-V, you have that same conundrum as well. There's conversion tools. Okay. But I'm a stack lock-in averting person, if that's the root of my objection.
Yeah, you know what? And I think everybody should be. One thing that they did talk about, and the name of it escapes me, and it's not shipping now anyway, but they were talking about, well, they're talking a lot, right, about becoming application-centric, right? Probably marketing buzz, I don't know, right? But we'd all like to be thinking about and provisioning against applications and things like that rather than virtual machines and stuff. Well, anyway, they had a lot of talk about becoming application-centric, and then about this application mobility fabric type thing, right, that would allow you to take an application and move it from Hyper-V to ESXi to their stripped-down version of KVM or whatever. And I'm like, okay, I kind of get what I think you're saying there, Rick, that people don't tend to really need that so much on the hypervisor side of things. Yeah, we change storage and stuff tons, right? But it would potentially, and this is probably even further out, right? We're talking about PowerPoint Ware here, okay? But they were talking about the ability maybe to shift it up into AWS or into Azure. Now, I did think that something like that would be potentially good going forward. So there's a lot of talk, at least, here coming out from Nutanix saying, no, it's not going to be lock-in, and they're going to bring out this application migration fabric, WeeWah, whatever they want to call it, which is like the opposite of lock-in, right? But it just exists on slides right now. I'm waffling, right? But I know what you're saying, Rick, I think.
There's one more part of it, and I have to be fair. Nutanix people love their Nutanix. They really are a very loyal customer base, and that's really to be applauded.
And that says a lot about it, yeah.
Yeah, the people that go down that route, they've generally been happy. That's what I've heard in my bump-ins in the community. Secondly, Nutanix is a very strong and, dare I say, aggressive brand. They take chances. And you have to take risks in this business, so I do applaud that. But it's a little much for the Rickatron.
Now, I know where you're coming from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they rub a lot of people up the wrong way. But you know what? Give them credit for going for it and for not rolling over and for, going for the jugular there with the likes of VMware and NetApp as well, actually. So anybody got any opinions on this scale-out file services platform that they've apparently got in the pipes?
It sounds like a really good idea to me, right? Why not? There's a lot of things that you can do, and people are interested in doing different things with file systems, and who knows what they're thinking about here. It'll be interesting to see how it evolves and what it's good for, right?
Yeah, I mean, in their product portfolio at the moment, at least the way I know it, you've got your compute and your block storage, and we've kind of converged, hyper-converged, call it what you want, the SAN down with compute and all of that, and bundled the hypervisor in this nice little package that they've got, but a missing element his NAS or his file services. And I bet you're right, a bunch of customers that buy Nutanix equipment, whether it's for VDI or for other things, have to go out and buy storage arrays that will take care of all of their files and things that they've got out there. And they've probably looked at their customers and said, you know what? That gravy that you're sending over to NetApp or EMC or whoever for buying NAS boxes and things, we'll have a bit of that. We'll collapse that down into our platform. And, I mean...
Yeah, I suspect, I mean, we were talking about this on Twitter earlier today. I suspect that Nutanix's customers have pretty much said, you need to do this.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, they wouldn't do it if they didn't have an addressable, interested market to do it.
We would buy 2 times or 3 times the amount of your stuff if you had this. Right. They're probably getting this kind of message.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants multi-protocol storage. You know, they want to be able to have their cake and eat it too. And okay, so it's silly not to. You know, it's like Amazon a few weeks ago, you know, finally offering a file service, you know, a simple file service.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, about time.
Yeah. You know what was interesting on this side of a scale out file service from Nutanix was there's word that they've had like Uber geeks working on this, like highly tuned and specialized erasure codes and things that will work more efficiently with a massively scale out file service. And apparently it's taken them 2 years to get it ready. I mean, it's not even ready yet, right? But it sounds like they've been baking it for a while at least. And I don't know whether it would necessarily be a direct competitor to something like Isilon, but I think they're in NetApp. People are going to hate me here, right? But I think there's a need in the market for there to be a good, solid competitor to Isilon in that proper, pure scale-out space. Don't know if this, whatever it's going to be from Nutanix, will be that. But if it is, I think that would make that kind of market a little bit more interesting at least.
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see how massively scalable it is, right? And whether it will compete with object-based storage. And it sounds like that might be where they're going, because when you talk about erasure code,
because
when you're talking about erasure code, you're talking about really big storage with really wide striping, and you can't use RAID with it anymore. You need something else, right? And when you talk about erasure coding, you're also talking about something that may or may not perform necessarily that fast, but it gets big enough and it's fast enough for a lot of things. Right. So, you know, if they're designing this for a really massive scale storage, it'll be interesting to see. And in that case, it will be up against Isilon.
Which will make that market more interesting. But you know what? One gripe I have had with Nutanix in the past is that they do talk a lot about being massively scalable. And I know a lot of their messaging, at least originally, was around like, you know, we're bringing Google-esque infrastructure to the masses, right? You know, we all, every time I've worked for a company, okay, and looked after their storage and Unix and stuff like that, we've always wanted secretly to be Google, right? And they've come through the door and said, well, you know, all this cool stuff that they do, horizontally scaling stuff at Google and commodity hardware and stuff, we'll let you do that. But I don't really think in the real world their hyperconverged platform has really scaled that well. You know, I've never heard of people that have got like masses and masses of nodes out there. And I just wonder, you know, they are talking about this massively scalable file storage system here. Yeah, I really hope they come good on it, because if they were to hype it like this and I was to get excited and, you know, I've done a bit of reading around what they're doing with erasure coding and stuff, and if they fail to deliver, I'll just be a bit gutted. Anyway, I know. I'm going to move us on real quick, guys, actually.
One more on Nutanix. One more just round out. A big question that came out of their event this week was really about their business. You know, are they going to do an IPO? And basically the quote right from the top is that basically we believe someday we have to go public, because only when we go public we will be more transparent, he said in an interview, quoting ZDNet here. But basically no IPO yet. They want to build up the other regions, in particular APAC, and then I think that's basically the next step when they have that ready to go, then that's next to look for from Nutanix.
Considering the investment they have, they need to have a much bigger run rate to have an IPO. It's my guess. My guess is the numbers don't really add up for them yet. They got that huge investment last year, and they probably need to have a lot more sales to justify the multiple of the investment.
Sure.
And I don't quite get that, Rick, when you say that that's the only way that they can become more transparent. What, financially?
Well, that's the quote. I'm not saying it. That was a quote.
That's Dheeraj.
Okay, right.
Yeah, right. So,
yeah, he'll say anything.
Yeah. Because normally when you IPO and it becomes more transparent, people are like, oh, dear.
Not exactly. Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah, people start making up, you know, really great obfuscations so they don't have to be transparent.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, you know what? On that topic, let's switch over to biz news. And on the topic of numbers and being transparent following IPOs, oh, dear. Okay, I mean, I'll run through all the business news that we've got first and we can come back to what we want. But, oh, dear, at the top of it, Violin posts another sorry set of results. Honestly, that's been like a, I don't know, a bit of a horror story to look at. Better news, though, software-defined scale-out storage startup Hedvig announced an 18 million Series B round of funding, taking, I think, their total venture capital to just maybe a smidge over 30 million. An interesting one here. I'd quite like to talk about this one a little bit. Chinese cloud provider Alion, another one that I don't know how to pronounce, a subsidiary of Alibaba Group, signs up partners to assist them with global expansion away from the domestic Chinese market, people like Intel and what have you. Apparently, they've got like a run rate of 50 billion. And I think I'm right in saying 50% of that's outside of China already. So this potentially massive cloud provider out of China spreading globally. Anyway, oh yeah, we mentioned earlier in the show about the new exec team at Cisco. Oh, and finally, the rumor that just will not go away, right? More talk of HP and EMC getting together and making ugly children.
Again?
It's just not going to go away. Does anybody have anything to say on Violin, first of all, though?
Yeah, nothing good. You know, I'm not surprised by that. You know, it's a tough market right now, but I don't see Violin coming up in people I talk to. But I'll flip around that financial news. It's a great deal. It's like a dollar stock right now. So.
Oh, yeah. Hey, there we go. Rickatron's picks another stock.
Yeah, but do not ever take financial advice from me, that's for sure. But it looks like a good deal.
Maybe we can get that lunatic Kramer to quote you.
You know what, though? When you look at their net losses over like every single quarter since like the dawn of time practically, and I'm being a bit harsh there, I don't know whether it would be a good buy. And like you say, they're not coming up in conversations with people that you're having, okay, they may be in other markets and things, fair play. But you know what? I had a question, to everybody, right? But particularly I was thinking Mark, because you've been in marketing at a lot of companies in the past. I do appreciate for Violin, right, that they're launching a new flash platform and they're winding down their old one. So they're in kind of an awkward period, right? Have you had experience, Mark, where you've worked for companies and you've been in that position where all of your customers know that you've got something shiny and new on the horizon and they're about to spend money and they're like, you know what, I don't want to spend anything on this stuff that's going to be kind of last year as soon as I've bought it. I'm going to hold off purchases until the shiny new stuff comes out. Have you been there when that's happened before, and how do you manage something like that?
Yes. I was trying to make a big sucking sound, but I failed. I got a few ice cubes in a cup and I missed. Oh, yeah. So what you do, right? You can't ever Osborne, right? The Osborne is where nobody buys your stuff. It waits till the new one and the new one gets delayed. Mm-hmm. So what you have to do is try to keep a wraps on it as long as you can. You just wait and then announce it. And then you got the situation where the old customers that just bought your old stuff are pissed off. And so you make special concessions to them going back like 6 months or something, because they would say, you weren't honest with me. And it's like, yes, but we're going to make you a good deal to make up for it. That's how you do it.
Uh-huh.
You don't do suicide in public.
Yeah. It sounds painful though. Like not something easy to manage with your customers and what have you, right? It's
you know,
tricky.
You know, you keep secrets. You know, the problem with them is that they've got issues with the old stuff. People don't want to buy it. So they want to make themselves look exciting, you know, so they talk about the new stuff. And then, you know, so in the meantime, their business just goes to hell. It's bad planning. It's really bad marketing, you know.
Do we think there's a future for Violin, like long term? Are they viable?
No, I don't think so.
I wonder.
Do they have any like components of the industry? Like, are they like a memory supplier?
Oh, I'm with you. Yeah,
you know what I mean.
No. Somebody could buy them. You know, somebody will eventually buy them. And you know, if they're lucky, it won't be for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, Josh, do you hear them come up very often? Are they a company that you or any of your customers would consider, or have considered, or have bought?
You know, I went through a storage refresh at my last job. I want to say maybe about six or eight months ago. And during that time, pretty much everybody was brought up never violent. And it was just never something that I considered, that management considered, that, I mean, really anybody that I talked to was, they've, any even partners, you know, some bars that we talked to, nothing. No, Violin never came up.
Damn it. I tell you what, we are railing on everybody today. The heck?
The hater show.
Well, yeah. this is kind of cool. Violin has a Windows flash array. That's kind of cool. What, WFA?
Do they have a Windows Phone flash array?
Oh, come on. Now you're just being ridiculous.
Do they have a Windows Phone app for that array?
Love this. I did see that there is a Nutanix app. Oh, yeah. If you go to Nutanix.com, it's like the big thing on their splash page. Well, at least it was when I looked at it earlier in the week. A proper Nutanix app for your phone so you can keep yourself up to date on Nutanix.next. I'll bet you've got it, Rick.
No, I do not, but you know, major events, they do that. They'll set up an event app.
All right, okay.
So I've done that, you know, in my professional role. All major events do their own app.
Fair play. Okay. So let's switch on to slightly better news than I think, at least. Hedvig. So, like I said, they've netted $18 million in a Series B, which is actually not very long after netting something like, I don't know, I think I remember it was about $15 million in Series A not so long ago. But I think these guys play in a particularly interesting space. So software-defined scale-out storage. Interesting as a technology and as a you know, a growing market and what have you, but increasingly crowded and competitive.
I mean, all they got was like a $3 or $4 million bump from the A to the B round.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That's not that good.
No, it's not. And I was curious as to why it was so soon as well. Anybody have any thoughts or experience as to why you might take a Series B so soon after a Series A?
Probably because you need it, but no real practical knowledge as to why.
I don't know. I mean, what if they just, you know, how long ago did they close the A? I don't know. I mean, was it within the last year?
Yeah, I think it was like February. Don't quote me on that. I'll have to look it up and make that straight in the podcast notes. But I've got a feeling it was February.
I mean, that sounds like a very flat round, actually. It's a head scratcher, right? Maybe they felt that the investment markets were going to close and it would be harder to get money next year or something like that. But normally you want to get a multiple, you know, three or 4X multiple of what you had in your A round. Now, their A round is pretty big.
Yeah.
Here it is. Maybe, A round, March 25th, $12.5 million. June 1st, $18 million B.
Wow.
Do you reckon they could be scrambling to be one of the first in that space?
Who's in the B round? Who are the investors in the B round?
And is it the same people that were in the A round?
Oh, gosh, you're putting me on the fact check.
No, that's okay.
We did B round, investment was led by Vertex Ventures with participation from True Ventures and Atlantic Bridge. Going back to the prior release from March, True Ventures and Redpoint participated, and also Atlantic Bridge. So some of the same faces, some new ones.
Yep. I think it's funny. I think the funding there strikes me as being funny, right? It's not the right direction at the right time. I don't know who all these companies are, but I would also say probably not the right investors either.
Okay.
Well, what the market they're playing in, right, for this build your own hyperconverged, basically. I hate to They're a distributed storage platform, but the way I look at the picture, it's a build-your-own distributed storage platform where you can do things like run VMs, run Docker containers, do Linux and Windows. So, you know, your own converged, basically, in a sense, where you've got the storage platform where you have your own hypervisor. It's not, I guess it's not properly converged because it is separate. At least there are two different colors. There's some APIs. That's cool, right? Yeah, maybe watch it. But, you know, dissecting the money, you know, I that's kind of weird for me. But it does support Object Swift, NFS, and iSCSI.
Yeah, so they've got to be hoping for an acquisition at some point because it's too much work to integrate all that stuff. Right. This is why Nutanix is hot, you know, and that's why people pay a premium, as we were talking about before with Josh. Why do people pay a premium for Nutanix? Well, they get everything. They don't have to do it themselves. Right. And if it's software only, it means that you have to put all of that together. And if you've got time and staff to do it, that's great. But it's not the way the whole hyperconverged business is about hardware and software together.
So it's not really a hyperconverged. It's really build your own storage, multi-protocol, object, file, block. So
okay. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Mark, are you off to the drill?
I am. Yeah, I'm going to go get my teeth drilled out.
Yep, good luck.
It'll probably be more fun than this podcast has been.
You know, we can dial you back in on the chair.
No.
That would make it interesting.
That was a bad joke. I'm sorry. Bye for now, guys.
Hopefully you survive. Hey, Rick, so a question for you on this Hedvig then, because I've thought for like the longest time that NetApp are awesome, okay, don't get me wrong, and all of the bells and whistles that you got on a filer back in the day were just like the absolute chizzing. I do not argue with that whatsoever. And they owned and dominated that kind of filer market for a very long time. But I do think one of the major reasons for that, at least, was that they were probably the first in there. And I wonder, okay, with regards to Hedvig here and taking a second or a B round of funding so quickly after an A round, whether they're really feeling that they need to get in there, so develop faster, get more boots on the ground to get more customers so that they can get in and be one of the first in that space. I wonder whether they're looking at that market and saying, you know what, if we don't take extra investment now and accelerate our customer adoption rate, is the market just going to drift away from us and we're going to be too late? I know you work for a vendor, right? And you're as a vendor at Veeam, you're trying to get into some new markets as well, aren't you, with regards to endpoint backup and things? And what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, you got to look at that opportunity, and you highlighted it, right? Let me push it another way. Build your own multi-protocol unified storage, including object storage. Who's out there doing that? There's not that many people. So that might be a use case that they're trying to, you know, get in early on, right? And it's very possible sometimes these types of things are ahead of their time. So maybe the thought of, you know, commodity storage, multi-protocol, object included, because, like, especially you could run it on your own ground, right? And you don't have to fully commit to something like OpenStack. Mm-hmm. Or you know, any other object storage that you're going to run locally, right? How else would you do that other than OpenStack, right? So maybe that's there. This emulates S3, okay? So S3 is an API, as I understand it. Really, if it's done to that spec, you can run it elsewhere. It doesn't always have to go to Amazon S3. So it's sure. The object storage protocol, but the DNS name of sorts is your local, in this case, Hedvig storage proxy. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think maybe they're going for a spot of being that first build your own multi-protocol, including object storage platform. And maybe they're ahead of their time. You know, maybe we're reading too much into the money, but to that question, if I needed that build your own multi-protocol, including object, I wouldn't know where to go. Now, Josh, I mean, kind of let me play it to your roles and, you know, your work experience. If you were ever told to build your own SAN and you needed object storage, what would you do?
I don't know. I mean, that's not something that I've, encountered before. So you got a use case that, you got a product that solves an issue that affects certain people. I mean,
yeah, who have that problem, right? Maybe there's an app that writes to object storage, and you don't want to send it to AWS. You know,
right? Exactly. And that's certainly something that's that would be pretty common. You start talking about, I mean, the amount of data that you're going to have to collect and having to, I guess, pay the cost of something like an EMC or a NetApp in order to store, you know, that data footprint. That's where it's going to get, you know, increasingly costly.
I'm reading the use case tab of the website, and it's loosely that, but doesn't quite say it that way.
Okay. You know what? We are winging it, and I do not doubt that we have done them a massive disservice.
We'll get another set of haters. Love
yeah.
it.
But genuinely, right, I'm personally quite interested in what they're doing, so I'm going to be keeping an eye on them. Probably do a bit more reading on them before next week's show and be able to speak on it a little bit better. But if you are interested in that space, definitely go check out Hedvig Storage, okay? Interesting market, potentially an interesting company with an interesting technology. Josh, quick question for you here. You don't have to answer it, okay? Just leading into a quick conversation around Chinese cloud provider Alien here. Are you American, Josh?
Yes, I am.
All right. Okay, so a Brit and two Americans left on the show. Now, I was thinking, would I trust my data to a Chinese cloud provider? And, you know, it's probably a shameful thing for me to say because I have absolutely no reason not to trust my data to them. In fact, the MiFi device that I'm recording the podcast via today is a Huawei device. So, you know, I've got Chinese technology here, and I'm not scared that that's got like some secret chip inside of it that's stealing secret podcast information and sending it back to.
Going to publish the podcast before it's released.
No.
Yeah.
Would either of you guys have any concern signing up with a cloud provider that was Chinese-based?
I don't know if I necessarily would. I think my biggest struggle would be pushing through that with, you know, senior management.
Right.
You know, you have investors, you have these people that you're accountable to, and are you really going to be able to say, don't they claim everything's going to be fine, so we're just going to throw all this data in China and everything should be good?
Uh-huh. Because I know that at least on this side of the pond, okay, there isn't a certain amount of apprehension around storing your data with American companies in light of all the Snowden leaks and the NSA and stuff like that. And the article that I read around this, what are they called again, Alien, in the comment section on the register.co.uk, were a bunch of people from this side of the Atlantic saying, you know what, I would trust those guys more than I'd trust the Americans. And I'm like, you know what, are we living in a world today where we don't trust anybody? Because I know the British government's always been accused of listening into telephone calls and that kind of jazz all the time. Is this like a serious concern, or is this just like, is this politicking, do we think? I think that a lot of these companies and the established Western nations and their governments fear China as a potential economic giant that they can't slay. So are we slinging food, and are they slinging it back at us? And is there a load of crap like that going on?
So, Nigel, this is a very deep question.
Uh-oh.
So,
yeah.
And it's...
I know.
It's... Yeah. This is like in the States, this is like the Sunday morning political TV stuff.
Oh, okay. Is it right?
Oh, yeah. So to your first question, would I trust a Chinese cloud provider? And it looks, friends, very much like AWS a la China. Mm-hmm. I would not have an inherent trust issue with that. However, anything I do in a cloud, I always think about the controls and the availability, right? Like most... The best way I use object storage in the cloud is to send my backups, mm-hmm. right? My own personal backups. And I'm managing encryption on my own for that, okay? So if any of the cloud platforms were to spy and do that, then I'd be okay. But the economic concern, you know, China is absolutely – well, they've surpassed Japan as the number two economy in the world, right, and are still moving – very well. So there's a lot of like global concern. From a technology standpoint, they're absolutely integral to the supply chain. So there's a certain inherent, you know, element there. And then there's another phenomenon, right? You mentioned Huawei, if I pronounce that wrong, I'm sorry for the components. But then there's that whole domestic market, okay, where there's server brands that, you know, you and I haven't heard of.
Oh, yeah.
Networking brands and all the whole stack storage, I'm sure. And there's an incredible phenomena going on here that I wish I had. And actually, in my role at work, we're actually investing in Asia. So I know that I'm learning this as I'm going. But it'd be really interesting to see what happens long term with this cloud, because I really think that Aliyun is going to work. It may be that natural choice for the Asia-Pacific region for a cloud platform. Granted, Amazon have footprints in those markets, especially like Singapore and Japan, I believe Korea now. But, you know, a Chinese one, there's going to be Chinese companies that can't have their data leave China. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to work. I'm looking at the price page. It's kind of funny. It says it's in English, but it's only like half in English. Then you go to the price page because I'm trying to convert it to see if it's price on par with Amazon. I'm looking at a Windows VM, but I can't understand how much this costs per hour. I have no idea. I just see the word Windows and the rest are in Chinese.
Oh, okay.
So I can't quite give me the page and the price yet, but I think this is going to work. I think this is a big deal. Alibaba is basically an e-commerce, you know, juggernaut for the region, of no doubt there, much like what Amazon had to deal with. So I think this is going to be a big deal.
Watch this space on that one, definitely.
Absolutely.
Then. Let's wind the show out with something, I was going to say lighter. I think we'll just give it a lighter treatment. It's not necessarily a lighter topic. This HP EMC thing, I don't want us to get like uber deep into this in any way, shape or form, right? But does anybody think it's a good idea for those two companies to merge, buy each other, whatever?
I'll defer that one to Josh as an end user, kind of his perspective. What do you think of that, Josh?
From my perspective, I mean, HP in, you know, the last few environments that I've worked in has, you know, certainly lacked relevance over the last few years. You know, it's much like violin for me. It you know, something that just never comes up in conversation. On the EMC side of things, though, I mean, until you start getting into like the larger companies where, you know, you have a storage solution for every problem that you might face, because, you know, the idea of an all-in-one storage solution that could theoretically do everything, like a NetApp, I guess, that isn't something that a lot of people seem to invest in. I think, you know, and again, this is me just, I guess, speaking off the cuff, is I think you could probably eliminate HP, and I don't think a lot of people that are looking for storage really notice.
Oh,
obviously the people don't. Now, a lot of people that work at HP are going to notice, but from my perspective, like, I don't know, I couldn't tell you what HP brings to the table that nobody else does.
So you're talking HP storage could disappear and nobody would notice, or HP the enterprise group could disappear and hardly anybody would bat an eyelid.
Okay, so you look at HP networking, you look at HP laptops, you look at HP storage. I mean, but to me, it's not a company that I would want to align my businesses with. Like, I never think that HP laptops or HP desktops for the enterprise are where I need to go. I never think that HP networking is what I need to invest in to run, you know, networking for my, you know, company. And same thing with HP storage.
Printers are like the pizzo, though, right?
Right. Maybe that's how they've gotten by this long. It's like they're that necessary evil. Everyone's got to print.
Well, the Register did a good job, I think, of identifying what I see as the one big problem with that happening. Personally, I don't think it will. Storage overlap. There's too much of it. Servers would be an excellent lineup to the EMC portfolio, especially if you play VCE dissolving. So the Cisco UCS may be dissolving and going away there. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the servers would be a great addition, but that's not what was split out. It was, you know, servers and storage are staying together. The networking, EMC doesn't have the networking option. Okay.
Oh, and they'd love to have that to give Cisco another kick in the teeth.
Right. See if it works, but right. Now, the overlap, and that's where, was it Chris? Yeah, Chris covered this on the register, Chris Miller. Too many overlaps on the storage categories. You know, you've got the, you know, the three pars and left hands tripping over the VMAXs and VNXs and data domain versus the store once. Now there is tape products, right? HP have tape products, right? And then there's what does that mean to well, see, and he even points out that VCE and VSpecs as converged systems, HP have converged compute, so that's, mm-hmm. you know, different. Yeah. There's a lot of overlap there. And that would be – but, you know, we've seen that before, right? A good example was the server side of HP. Let's go back about, I don't know, 10 years when HP bought Compaq.
Yeah.
You know, HP and Compaq both had industry-standard servers.
Oh, but Compaq were miles better. Exactly. Miles, but yeah.
But is the VMAX better?
No.
Than,
no.
Or is the VNX better than the 3PAR?
No.
Is, you know, but, you know, there's a Extreme IO. I mean, there's a lot that Chris pointed out here, right? But, you know, some of them would go, like the MSA 2000. If remember, that's OEM from Dot Hill.
That's right.
So, and then there's even backup software, right? Data Protector, Legato,
that would,
and
that
Apple
would go.
Mark.
Yeah, no, Data Protector
so
would go.
It, there's a lot of overlap. I mean, I don't know where this chatter is coming from.
It's money people, isn't it? And money people are important, don't get me wrong. I totally appreciate that. But it's all just about making money off of it. Because the way I see it, right, you're right, there's a ton of overlap in the storage space there that would make it tricky. But if it was HP, well, I don't even think it matters who was buying who or if it was a merger. The one single solitary successful HP acquisition I can think of is the 3PAR acquisition. And that was a lot down to David Scott and his team. And we've talked about that before. I cannot put my finger on another successful HP acquisition. So trying to acquire EMC is just a disaster for customers. Yeah, a bunch of people might make some money out of it. And you know what? I haven't got a problem with that. Only in the fact that it would destroy any services that either company delivers to their customers for at least 5 years.
Well, I don't know. I think that I don't know what you define as a successful acquisition.
But oh, they've had some horrible ones. Name me another good one other than 3PAR.
How about Left Hand?
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. It took them like – how long ago did they acquire Left Hand, and only now is that coming good? And Left Hand was like a five-man startup, you know, in somebody's garage when they bought them. Mm-hmm. Not quite, okay, but in comparison to EMC, yes, I have no problem with the Left Hand product. It is coming good now, but that is a lot of years after they picked them up. EMC is a different beast to swallow. They've not done a large-scale acquisition other than 3PAR that has been anything even close to resembling a success.
I cannot disagree. And it took them a while even with Compaq. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't disagree with that, but at least in that Left Hand example, I think it's actually good for what it is at that price point, and most importantly, the usability. So I think that was a good example.
Yeah, no, fair play. And you know what? I'm not grinding on HP. I like HP as a company. And Josh, I'm quite offended as to what you've said about them. You'll never be on the podcast again now. But I do like HP, and I think they've got some cracking storage products. And I desperately don't want this acquisition merger thing to happen, because I really like EMC as a company as well. And I love the competition between the two of them. But if it did happen, holy cow, would it not be interesting to see what products stayed and what products went and what happened? That would be very interesting.
That would be something. That would be some, you know, not to cuss, but that would be some beep.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, guys, do we have anything else before we wrap the show up?
I've got nothing to add. You know, it's getting into summer here in the States, you know, kind of a weird, somewhat quiet time. My travel is going to slow down starting next week, so I'm super happy about that. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, good luck to Mark at the dentist. Josh, thanks again for being on the show. Really appreciated your input. Just remind the listeners of what your Twitter handle is.
Eurobrew.
Cool. All right. To all the listeners, thanks again for listening. And thanks for everybody's participation in LinkedIn groups and discussions and other stuff that we got going on, Facebook, all of that kind of jazz. In the absence of Hans, I'm going to have to start trying to pick some of that stuff up, work out how I can get logged onto the Facebook account and everything. But until next week, thanks for listening.